Men, when we leave the house, it's phone, wallet, keys, how's my hair look? But if you're experiencing hair loss, you may not be so confident when you step outside your door. It's time to get that confidence back and restore your hair with Hims. No man wants to lose his hair, but for men, it's actually quite common. And now with Hims, the solution is simple. Try Hims Hair Loss Solutions and you'll be joining hundreds of thousands of subscribers who got their flow back. Men, real talk. The only thing worse than losing your hair is waiting forever for it to grow back. That's why you need Hims, and you can start seeing your hair grow back in as little as 3 to 6 months. Hims provides access to a range of hair loss treatments that work, all from the comfort of your couch. Hims makes treating hair loss simple, with doctor-trusted treatment options and clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil that can regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. They offer personalized chewable, oral, spray, and serum treatment options, so you can find what works best for you. The process is simple and 100% online. Just answer a few questions and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to your door. Hims has hundreds of thousands of trusted subscribers, so if you feel like you're losing a part of yourself with your hair loss, get Hims and get your confidence back. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your personalized hair loss treatment options. hims.com/Hail Mary. Results vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil. Prescription products require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
What's up, Open Floor Globe? I'm your host, Michael the Pod Pina, and I'm joined on the other line by my good friend, Sports Illustrated senior writer Chris Herring. Chris, I am currently located in a hotel room in downtown Minneapolis here for Game 6 between the Grizzlies and the Timberwolves. I've been flying back and forth between these two cities for what feels like an eternity. My brain is scrambled eggs. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm good. I legitimately feel bad. And I was expressing that before that you've been so on the go, man, but it's part of what makes you great. And I don't know. I hope the series ends soon so that you can at least shift your focus a little bit and also get back home sometime soon, because we're going to need you for the playoff run, man. We're running your minutes a little bit high.
You mean after this series, there's more basketball? Is that how this works?
That's generally how it works, unfortunately. But yeah, that is generally how it works.
Wonderful. On today's show, you and I will be opening up the mailbag and we will be previewing a few second round matchups. But first, a quick reminder to please keep your emails coming. openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. All right, Chris. Last night in Toronto, the Sixers they shocked me. I don't know if they shocked everyone by blowing out the Raptors 132-97. James Harden looked like James Harden, which wasn't great news for Gary Trent Jr. Joel Embiid looked like Joel Embiid despite the thumb injury. Tyrese Maxey was at times the best basketball player in the country of Canada. What was your main takeaway just watching that game, mostly as it relates to this Sixers team going forward? And were you as surprised as... I can't even speak for everyone, but I was pretty, I mean, at halftime, it was looking like a toss-up game, and then the Sixers just kind of ran them off the court. Just like, were you as surprised as I was by the end result?
A little bit. Not the result, but the size of the result, the blowout nature of it. It was weird. You know, earlier in the week, as I do every week, I'm normally trying to figure out what I want to kind of lead my newsletter with, our newsletter with at SI, called The Playmaker. And to me, there was starting to be so much noise around the Sixers and the Raptors series, a lot of which we saw Doc Rivers respond to earlier in the week. And
Can we pause right there for 2 seconds?
Sure, please. Go ahead.
What are your thoughts on Doc and the defensiveness?
Okay, two thoughts. And maybe this is me liking Doc as a person. I don't know very many people that don't like him as a person. He's very candid. He talks to everybody. He makes everybody feel like, you know, your long lost friend, which is one of his specialties. I don't mind him being defensive about something that, I mean, like everybody harps on it. Everybody harps on it. And I do think that it's a two-way street. One, damn, you've lost a lot of games or lost a lot of chances to close out a series. But on the other hand, like he's been in a lot of playoff series. He's won a lot of series. He's won a championship. He's gotten his team to that point, which is not difficult considering some of the teams he was coaching. The Clippers, I mean, their history, the stuff that was going on when he first took over the job, the fact that his teams were banged up. So you're always, when we think about our mistakes in life, and maybe some people are not like this, and God bless them if they're not, we normally caveat the things that we failed at or that we maybe let slip through the cracks. We provide context for those things. So I don't blame Doc for doing that. What was a little bit eye-opening, and for once agreed with someone on Inside the NBA, Kenny Smith was saying, like, why are you even going down that path with them?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they're asking the question, but on some level, you're up 3-2. You're not even in a spot yet where it's 3-3, where you even have a game 7 to worry about yet. So why even kind of give them the ammunition to go further with it to show that you're defensive and that your mindset is that we somehow have to be thinking about this? Like, you're really theoretically at least one game and maybe two away from even having to think about blowing this lead. So don't go there with them. Don't fuel their fire even more. And I do agree with that. But I also didn't, you know, I still picked, I was on a quick radio appearance yesterday in Toronto and said I still would not pick the Raptors to win the series. I still think it's a little bit of an uphill battle for them. They played very well the last few games. But it's difficult to do that. And why I led my newsletter with Harden was the fact that I kind of felt like all it would take for him is to have one big breakout performance. And that was essentially what I was saying in the newsletter is, if Harden plays well, it plays up to his capabilities even once, that could be enough to close the series out. It's just that when Maxey and Harris and Embiid are not playing particularly well, that's what you have someone like Harden for. That's what he's supposed to do. So I know he has not been 100% himself lately, but mm-hmm. it really took one knockout blow from him. And obviously, like you said, the other guys played well too. But it wasn't stunning that it happened. It was just stunning to see like the second half collapse from the Raptors, really third quarter collapse. The game was really over by the end of the third quarter.
Philly's offense showed up. Danny Green hit some huge threes in the first half that really kept them. Because I felt like that was the type of game where if the Sixers went down double digits in the first half, it could have gotten pretty sure. ugly going the other way. Because Gary Trent was hitting shots. Scottie Barnes was hitting shots. Real quick about Doc. Do you remember like 10 years ago when it was like Greg Popovich, Rick Carlisle, Doc Rivers, those were like the three amigos. Those are like the three, like hands down best coaches. And it's just like funny to me how when you coach as long as Doc has, like he's fourth all time in postseason wins, has a winning percentage in the playoffs. I don't know. Like I just think like the blown lead stuff is just like kind of corny, and I feel like he had it up to here, and it makes me feel like he also has a burner account on Twitter and is just like obsessing over what people are saying about him, because I don't know why.
That's what I'm saying. Back. I mean, it's gotten, we've seen some real extremes with a lot of things the last few years, and you know, it's not often that I talk about kind of just, but I just kind of feel like there's so much groupthink on Twitter and I mean, it doesn't, I'm not upset that people ask the question about it. Like, okay, you're a reporter. You have every right to ask the question. Doc Absolutely. Has every right to answer it the way he wants to answer it. I'm not upset that he did it that way. Like I said, I'm human. I probably would think that way too. And I'm sure he heard all the stuff about Nick Nurse and how he's going to run circles around Doc in the series. And I mean, it didn't happen. And there are potentially other reasons that the Raptors didn't win the series. Obviously they were banged up, incredibly banged up. Throughout the series, starting the series, the end of the series, obviously without Van Vliet, which in some ways maybe helped him because he was hobbled. But, you know, if I was Doc, I would be tired of some of it too. So I understand being defensive. But I also think that he's a good enough coach to potentially for them to win a championship with him. Like, they've got the talent if everything goes right. If Harden plays up to his capabilities and if Embiid can play through the thumb, which yesterday was a very good sign for that. Like, we don't need to – it's not that Doc is such an albatross for them that they can't win. Like, and if that's the case, then there are larger problems there than a Toronto series. So, anyway, I think some of that stuff was overblown. I understood why he responded the way he did, even if I kind of winced a little bit as I watched him do it.
Yeah, so just talking real quick about the game, and then we're going to look forward to their matchup against the Heat. But I did think it was interesting how Doc started the second quarter with Embiid on the court for the first time in the playoffs. That's not something that Embiid, that's just not their rotational pattern at all. And I found that interesting just in terms of how they were playing the matchups going in the second quarter. Harden is just this fascinating variable right now. And you did a really good job highlighting that in your newsletter. Like, part of me is kind of like, what are the Raptors just the, especially when Fred VanVleet can't play, are they this just the worst possible matchup for him? And you saw in game six, like when Gary Trent Jr. wasn't on the court, he couldn't find anyone to hunt, and he was having a lot of success blowing by Gary Trent Jr. But then it's kind of like the ISOs weren't quite there, and when he was run pick and roll, you know, their strategy, that the Raptors strategy is essentially, we're just gonna take away Embiid on the short rolls, we're gonna stick with him on the pops, and we're just gonna give Harden this line draft, like a runway into the paint. And to Harden's credit, like, you saw it from the jump. He saw that runway and he had that dunk in the first quarter. And it was like, okay, Harden sees what's up. He has adjusted from that late regular season strategy. And we're getting Harden. I'm fascinated though, if we're going to see this guy, cause like he's about to go up against this switch everything defense that completely neutralized Trae Young. In the first round, Bam Adebayo, one of the best switch bigs in league history. I'm fascinated to see how the Miami Heat guard that pick and roll. Just what are some of your like initial thoughts on this matchup? And in particular, like how they're going to guard that action? Because it's a fascinating one that could decide the series.
Well, like you said, it's a switch everything team. I mean, my first initial thought with all of it was that, you know, as we come out of one series where the Raptors had an injured, banged up point guard, so do the Heat. I don't know exactly what the prognosis is on Lowry. But like you said, in some ways, having a pick and roll point guard who is going to kind of invite switch after switch after switch after switch. There's that meme. What is it? Is it Goofy? Where he just opens one door and then there's another door, and then there's another door. That's how Miami feels on defense. And so I don't think Miami's afraid, you know, like you look at, and I don't think that Harden played, but maybe one game against Miami this year, but it was not a particularly memorable game for him. It was a forgettable game for him. And Embiid's numbers were not, I think he had one good game against Miami, but they were not great against Miami either for this season. So, I mean, this is a team that is capable, certainly, of guarding Philly. And I think what's interesting is that Toronto went into this knowing that you have to take away certain guys. And I think the problem with it for the Raptors was that at the beginning of the series, that really hurt them because it meant they were leaving other guys open and letting those guys get off. Maxey, Tobias Harris played really well to start the series. Miami ain't got to do that. And I mean, to some extent, I think the case is the same thing now when we watch Milwaukee in their series, is the fact that the Bulls basically had to sell out on Giannis and leave other guys open. And Boston's defense is not going to invite those sorts of advantages when Milwaukee plays in that matchup. So the second round adjustments are going to be really interesting just because the defenses are so much better. for some of these teams than what teams like Milwaukee and Philly saw in the first round. Not that Toronto's defense is bad, but just that it was different. And like the fact that, okay, Toronto didn't have the size to guard Embiid straight up. Miami will have that to some extent, or at least guys that are not going to really struggle as much with some of these matchups, I guess is maybe the best way to put it.
Yeah, to me, this series could just very well come down to the help offensively for Philly in terms of Tobias Harris, Tyrese Maxey. Like, is Furkan Korkmaz going to get minutes? George Niang, you need to hit your threes.
Ooh, he needs to hit threes this series. My goodness.
Yeah. That could be like, that's, I think, the number one thing for me, because I anticipate them switching and then fronting Embiid. And then when Embiid gets it, you know, doubling, just a lot of help, a lot of aggression, packing the paint, which is what they do so well and why their switch scheme is so effective. But like on those kickouts, like those guys got to hit those shots. And Maxey is particularly this fascinating X factor for me, because he is very good. And I, you know, you mentioned earlier the Lowry predicament. I don't know who is going to check Tyrese Maxey and how they can keep him in the half court. He's just like good for 6 to 8 points a game, strictly off of, like, even in the playoffs, like even against like a disciplined team like the Raptors, a disciplined transition defense team, like he'll push. And
there was a play yesterday. There was a play yesterday. I'm trying to remember whose offensive foul it was, but it happens sometimes in football where you get someone that almost holds, and it's like a preemptive hold because the running back gets out there so fast that the offensive lineman doesn't know what the hell is going on. And there was someone, it might have been Niang, I think, who set a screen, and it was like they didn't even get a chance to set the screen properly, so they're still moving because Maxey just blew past in transition, basically. The guy is so fast. So it'll be interesting to watch, man. Like, it'll be really interesting to watch. The switching is just at a level, obviously, in part, large part because of Bam. There's just so much switching that happens. Like you mentioned before, Harden often hunts people out, but I don't know what that looks like against the defense. The other thing that becomes really interesting in this series too is how does stuff change, for instance, when Hero is in the game?
Exactly. I was going to say that.
Because that is naturally someone that you would hunt if he's on the court for long stretches, which, you know, the questions about Miami, I don't think are normally about their defense. It's probably more offense-based. And so you're going to want to have Hero on the court, but in those moments where you do that, how much is he attacked in the pick and roll?
Yeah, Harden did not play at all. Did not play Miami at all after the trade deadline. And even when he was not out there, they attacked Hero mercilessly, infamously, in Philadelphia. I do think that that's a really intriguing one. And I also think that, like, does Eric Spoelstra have this newfound confidence in Victor Oladipo to play in this series after the performance that he had? And could he get some of those minutes? I don't know. Just a fascinating little wrinkle
isn't
here.
It's not weird. Because, I mean, they've also had this happen before where you get Oladipo and then he gets hurt. And then you're scrambling trying to figure out how to replace the points that he scores. He's like a designated scorer with the way they use him, where literally do not use him at all. And then just comes in and can drop 20. It's very, very interesting in a way that I can't really remember happening much. I'm trying to just on the spot now thinking about it, but yeah, I mean, I could see him getting spot minutes, but is he a regular part of the rotation? If their offense struggles, then maybe you have to throw him in there, but I still don't know if he's going to be an everyday part of the rotation now in the series, even with how well he's played.
No. Yeah. I mean, I'm just more thinking of it as like, if, first of all, we don't really know Lowry's status,
right?
We don't know Jimmy Butler's status. And that is, that's pretty concerning, I would say, honestly. Like, he was by far their best player in that first round matchup against the Hawks. One of the best players in the entire postseason.
When is game one? for that series?
That's a wonderful question. I think Monday, don't quote me on that, because like I said at the top, my brain is scrambled eggs.
It is Monday. You're right. Monday night. Okay. So that sort of thing, maybe it was a little, I know in our group chat, which we've talked about how I'm either all the way in the group chat or I'm not really paying attention. But we were all
I envy not paying attention.
we were all a little bit surprised when Butler was a scratch when he wasn't playing. So you would hope now that having missed the last game and now having until Monday, we're talking on Friday right now, that those extra days help a lot. And, you know, the idea that you were able to close out without him having to play is probably a good feeling, too. But it is interesting. I mean, if he can't go, my feelings change about certainly the first game, but also the series a little bit. If he's not right until game two, game three, if he's not playing until then, obviously it's obviously a huge, huge blow for them in a series like this.
Yeah. I'm really interested to see who they put on Maxi. You know, PJ Tucker spent minutes just hounding Trae Young in the last series. I feel like that was a good tune-up for, and obviously it's a completely different situation because Maxi is the third offensive option and Trae Young is everything to that offense. So it's a little different, but I am fascinated to see how they, because a part of me is almost like, I know Maxi is not the head of the snake here, but like, he's just so explosive and dangerous and threatening. And now that he has, like, he's got the step back in his bag pretty consistently. He's just like, you can't sleep on him at all, especially in the pick and roll when you're running Harden and Embiid and you throw it to him and, you know, the help defender, his man is like at the elbow, turns his head for a second and boom, Maxie's like at the rim. Like, those plays are just humongous. You got to be on point at all times. And like, you know, there were stretches in the first round where the Heat went super duper small, took Deadman out of the rotation a little bit. I wonder if we're going to see that again when Embiid is not on the floor in the Paul Reed minutes, B-ball Paul. So it's a very fascinating matchup. What is your pick for this series? Did you submit one? I know we had a round table.
Oh, shoot. I did not submit that. I know Drill probably hates me. I have them all written down, but I have not. I haven't written out what my thought would be for the, who is it? The other team in the West. I haven't figured out yet who I would pick it, depending on the Memphis Minnesota series, which is kind of like a speculative sort of thing on that, but I have all the other three series picked out. And again, you raised some questions about Jimmy and like, what does that look like? We're talking about Lowry. If Miami is healthy, relatively healthy for the series, meaning that they have Butler for the majority of it or the whole thing, and Lowry is back within a game or two, I would pick Miami in six in this series. I just kind of feel like their defense is swarming. I feel like their defense has the potential to cause more problems than Toronto's could, or at least with Embiid, that it's not going to require as much help to guard Embiid as what Toronto was showing. I think Miami can be a little bit more disciplined than what Toronto was with all the fouls at times. I don't know. I just kind of feel like this is a series where I think Miami can score enough, but I think their defense is going to make life hell for Philly at times in the series.
I have Miami in six as well. And part of it is, I mean, it's just like, I hope everybody's healthy. I know Embiid can't be healthy because of his thumb, and that's a factor here. I also think that if there's any, like, Toronto's defense was pretty, it was built to slow down what makes Philly's offense great. I think, you know, Boston's built in a similar way. Miami's built in a similar way. And I'm really intrigued by the potential to put PJ on Harden also. Have PJ hound his good friend, former teammate, James Harden, up and down the floor and switch those Embiid Harden pick and rolls where Bam goes on Harden and PJ goes on Embiid, and then you can double. And I think that is just like that's going to be a like a bloodbath. I hope that's the matchup. That'll be a lot of fun. And yeah, I think, you know, honestly, like, I just never expected the Sixers to have the type of game they did in game six. And it kind of warps my point of view a little bit. Like, I think this will be a way more competitive series than I thought 3 or 4 days ago or 2 days ago, but still going Heat in six. And hope Jimmy's okay, because the way he was playing was awesome. And one of the questions that I had coming into this entire postseason is, can we see the Jimmy of 2-3 years ago in the bubble, where he's just like doing absolutely everything and he's way more aggressive scoring the ball? And he answered that in the first round in a favorable defensive matchup. And this one is, they need him to be just as aggressive, I think, to beat this team. And it'll be fascinating to see if he can do it. Okay, let's move on to the Western Conference. And what might be my favorite, I think my favorite second round series, I'm not going to lie. Suns and Mavericks. Both teams won last night. Before we get into this, do you have anything to say about the Utah Jazz?
I was wondering whether you're going to bring this up, my friend.
Yeah, because I feel like we got to hit this. I did not have any outline.
And I was wondering whether you wanted to, or, you know, if maybe there was a reason you held them out. Because I think that, first of all, and I will own it, they were my preseason pick again to come out of the West. I can't remember if I picked them to win the whole thing or not. I don't think so. But, I was thinking that the Rudy Gay experiment and Eric Paschal, that was, you know, like, oh, this is, I understand the logic here. I think this is really smart. And, you know, and it's like that SpongeBob meme. It's like 6 months later. No, I mean, Rudy Gay did not play in this series at all. They struggled with the same things that really got them eliminated last year. And
it's painful.
Yeah,
it's like painful to watch. Like Maxi Kleber threes.
It's torturous. And it was, you know, the way I described it in the newsletter was that it was like the most torturous, like NBA style Groundhog Day sort of thing you could possibly imagine. And it, I think, inevitably spells the end of like this iteration of the Jazz, whether we see Quinn Snyder back, whether we see the two stars from the roster back in Gobert and Donovan Mitchell, or whether we see them split up. I kind of feel like the odds on at least one of those three things changing is definite. At least one will. I kind of feel like it would be more likely that we'll see two of them swapped out, probably most likely being, I would think, probably Gobert. And if it's their choice, meaning if Donovan Mitchell doesn't want out, if it's their choice, then I'm assuming that it would be Quinn maybe going elsewhere and them finding a new home for Gobert and them trying to build around Mitchell. We obviously have Rohan, who, you know, wrote about the idea of like, keep those two together. I think in theory sounds great. And like, you don't want to overreact necessarily. They have gotten knocked out exactly the same way multiple years now. But also there's the question of like, whether these guys like each other, which you don't have to win big, but when you're losing, I won't say big, but when you're losing consistently, when you're one of the best teams in the league, but you can't get it done in the playoffs, something about the composition has to change. It could be the coaching. We watched that sort of thing play out with Milwaukee, they're making a coaching change and then making a jump right away. It didn't result in a title right away, but it did help them win a title eventually.
Correct, but I will say the coaching was
there were a lot of questions about that too.
And
there were a lot also, of questions about that too.
Yeah, and they also had a guy named Giannis Antetokounmpo, and they had the pieces to make a trade for a guy named Jrue Holiday. None of that is on the table in Utah.
Right. So, I mean, there'll be some things to figure out, but my thought is you can't underrate how important it is to have two guys that can gel, hopefully like each other, but if they don't, that they can work together a little bit better than those two have. And to some extent, some of the sieve-like tendencies they have defensively are because of Mitchell, which don't do Gobert any favors. So the idea of having them together, you could swap out Conley and figure out a way to handle his situation and some of the other guys. on that roster, but I kind of feel like it might make more, a lot more sense to break them up at this point, regardless of which one you're losing. I think it's actually a very good debate as to which player you would rather try to build around. I'm not sure what the answer is. I know what most people would say, but I have questions about whether Donovan Mitchell is a guy that you, I mean, mm-hmm. I get why Utah's not running away from him and would want to figure out with him. It's a hard place to get superstars to come play. So just letting go of him, and I don't even know if he's a superstar, but like getting someone of his caliber to come play there is not a given. So I don't expect them to write him off and just move on from him. But yeah, I think you have to change something about the composition there in a major way.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Here's a little hypothetical for you. You're Danny Ainge or ownership or Dwayne Wade or whoever. Donovan Mitchell comes to you and says, like, if you don't trade Rudy Gobert this offseason, I'm making it known that I want to be traded. What do you do in a situation like that? And before you answer, in our last episode, we talked about this a little bit, and I was more on the train of moving on from Donovan for a couple reasons. Some of it is what you can get back in an actual trade. Some of it is, you know, the idea of building around Donovan is just a lot harder than just keeping Gobert and shuffling in pieces and being competitive and hopefully having enough assets to like let this Gobert era be a bridge where you can stay competitive and you don't have to bottom out and be like the Sacramento Kings for a few years or anything like that.
Which, by the way, that's Utah up until recently, Indiana's MO. Like these teams have basically never gotten the top pick because of that, because they are in small markets where they're afraid to lose any remnant of attendance. And so they just, they want to stay decent and try to find a way to rebuild out of decency as opposed to bottoming all the way out. So that matters here.
Which I can totally understand and I get. And the other thing is, you know, you hear, you know, these are just, I'm just passing along rumors and whispers and stuff, but you talk to anyone, talk to a lot of people, and I've been doing it. The Jazz are a very popular topic of conversation out here in Minnesota and in Memphis, and just writers and just people around teams talking. Not a lot of people have positive things to say about Donovan Mitchell. I'll just say that in terms of his personality and kind of getting along with everybody else. There are aggressive words that are used that I don't need to say on a podcast about how people feel about him in Utah that I can't substantiate. But like, I think that there's just like a negative vibe there where you can't just trade Rudy and then everyone's just going to be like happy. And I was texting someone last night, kind of joking around, but like, I wonder like what percentage of Bojan Bogdanovic was like, I don't want to make this shot and keep playing.
Wow. Bruh. Did you just say that? I mean, I will say I will say this in a joking tenor as well. The way he missed that thing, like it did kind of feel like he didn't want to make it. It was, man, he missed that shot by a lot. Which, by the way, if this is the end for Quinn Snyder, who's done a good job there, a very good job, I think, in my opinion, over the years, I thought it was weird that the inside the NBA crew was like skewering him last night, saying, man, this is a horrible coaching job. Like, okay, yeah, your team is pretty vested in the idea of Rudy Gobert being a rim protector, and the fix that they made, again, that I was a dupe enough to fall for, was that you were going to go get small ball centers that could, you know, nullify the ability to just kind of rotate you that way. Beyond that, I'm not really sure what the answers were with how bad their perimeter defense was. So what I will say on his way out, if this is the end for him, that play call that they had at the end of that game to get Bogdanović that shot was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, granted, the pass wasn't great. And so the defender, I think, was it Dinwiddie, was able to catch up to Bogdanović and force a pump.
He still caught him on a flyby, yeah.
Right. But I mean, like, you know, Bogdanović caught him on the fake and, you know, and got him out of the frame on the fake. He missed that shot by a lot. So again, do I think he was hoping to miss it? Of course not, but he missed that thing by quite a bit considering how open he was. It was a pressure filled situation, but it felt like a merciful end. Utah, I did not really want to see Utah in the next round. Game sevens are always cool, but I did not really want to see them in the next round.
Okay. Now let's go back to my hypothetical about Donovan and Gobert. What are your thoughts on that bad question, Chris?
Look, I think you're spot on about the idea. I mean, this is a very good kind of barbershop versus analytics sort of question of like, which player would you rather keep and why? I could very easily see a scenario in which they retool with whatever they get back from a Donovan Mitchell trade and do, I won't say better, but like that they are more.
Could be better.
They're still a playoff team. I would actually expect them to be a playoff team still if they do that, if they get the right pieces back, if they really study and figure out who they want back in a trade. And I imagine there would be plenty of offers out there for him. With Gobert, I mean, I don't know what that looks like. And maybe that's a good thing to some extent, is that you have to really revamp all the way. But you know, on some level that his players like him, you at least would have a sense of how you wanted to build. Maybe you could get some other players, some better perimeter defenders that don't make you as vulnerable to what the Jazz were vulnerable to this year and last year in the playoffs. So I could very easily see a scenario in which it makes more sense to keep him. Doesn't mean you don't kind of really take a deep gulp when you look at his contract numbers and everything else like that, because anybody that's making almost $50 million in any year, you're going to feel that way about, particularly if it's someone that doesn't really create his own shot a whole lot. Mm-hmm. But I could easily see a universe in which there's still a very good competitive team with him. Whereas I would have actually more questions about, if you trade Gobert, what do you get back for him? That would be really interesting to see like what his trade value is throughout the league and what that trade looks like. Whereas Mitchell, you know, you'd be getting a lot back for him. Players that don't, you know, that aren't taking 35% of your shots and aren't, mm-hmm. you know, aren't shooting 9 for 24 a lot of the time. He has a credible value, but that does drag down your offense sometimes too.
So there's a fake trade, whatever scenario that's been kind of floating around that I've seen in various places. And I was just talking about it with someone at Shoot Around, at a Timberwolves Shoot Around. Gobert for Ben Simmons, straight up swap. Who says no to that?
I'm not super excited about that. First of all, Brooklyn's not saying no.
Brooklyn should absolutely say yes to that. In my opinion,
if Brooklyn says no, I'm going to hit them upside the head and like ask what's wrong with you, because that would be. Think about Claxton and all the free throws he missed in this past series. Like all the things that you get out of Claxton, which are wonderful, by the way. He's a young player. I mean, the free throw misses are not wonderful, but like he's a good young player. But think about the fact that he started 0 for 10, right? From the line. Mm-hmm. Gobert, yeah. I mean, for all the things the man is criticized for offensively and, you know, not – you know, how do you pay someone that much for someone that can't create their own shot? The man can make free throws. I mean, so there's that, but also he's a great rebounder. He's a great defender in a series where, quite frankly, you know, Brooklyn was not very good on defense. Now they were playing against a difficult offense and some really great players offensively, but Gobert would make them a very, and he's been healthy for the most part. I mean, he gets hurt every now and then too, but Ben Simmons, I don't know what you have with him. So if I'm the Jazz, I'm not excited about that at all. I'm just not. I mean, maybe it's sexy from the standpoint of he's a young player and maybe the value on him is so low for a lot of people that you could get a star, quote unquote star, in a small market. But I'm thinking about, you just talked about difficult personalities, difficult people to read in terms of Donovan Mitchell. You want to throw Ben Simmons in that situation? Okay. By all means, go ahead. But Brooklyn would do that in less than a heartbeat, I'm sure. What do you think?
Yeah. I think the Gobert fit is tremendous. Just thinking of him running high pick and roll with like KD and you have Joe Harris, Seth Curry, Kyrie, whoever else is on the court spotting up, like, okay, ball game, game over. Like, that's the best offense I can even imagine in my head. And defensively, yeah, he's Rudy Gobert. Great fit. So then you look at Utah and you're kind of like, would Ben Simmons even report to Salt Lake City? Would he ever even step foot in the state of Utah after getting traded there? Like, that's, who knows? I don't know. So that's a tough one. But that's it's just a fun, when we're trying to think of like possible Gobert trades, I think that that's just an interesting one. I don't think there's too much weight behind it, especially when you think back to the, I'm sure they've squashed it by now, but like that beef that Donovan and Ben Simmons had during the rookie of the year.
Man, that feels like four lifetimes. Oh, yeah, it does. About that. But that whole thing was so weird. And so I'm not mad at fan bases caring about their rookie winning rookie of the year, but that, like, I wouldn't mind if people ratchet down the tribalism that comes with that. Like, somebody asked me about that yesterday about the votes and whether I enjoy being a voter. I was like, because you have, I'm not going to call people weirdos, but you get people, I mean, people are allowed to tweet you and ask you questions. We've been on threads together where people ask why you vote this way. And maybe I'm just sensitive to it now in a way that I shouldn't be. But some people are just like so up in arms about it to where it's, they call you out of your name. They call the other players out of their name. And it's just like, it's not, there are really good options for rookie of the year in a way that sometimes there really aren't. There are fantastic options for MVP in a way that sometimes there really aren't. Coach of the year this year, you could have gone in a lot of different directions. There were so many, half the league was kind of really impressive from a coaching standpoint this year. So I'm fine with people being diehard fans, but like diehard should not mean that you're more or less like hoping that someone dies, that a voter that, you know, that doesn't vote the way you want, or, you know, that you're stupid because you like at worst, we're talking about someone winning MVP who was either like 27, 8, 14 and 8, or someone that was like 31, 11 or 31 and 12 and 3, or someone that was like 29, 9 and 7 or whatever Giannis was with some of the best defense in the league. Like, what are we talking? Like, these are all great options. So anyway, that's my rant. That's my soapbox. I'm going to step down now. But yeah, the rookie of the year thing I'd forgotten about between Simmons and Donovan Mitchell, it literally feels like it was forever ago, and it really was not.
It really was, actually. It was forever ago.
What was it? How far ago was that? 4 years? 3 years?
Five. I want to say at least 5 years.
Are those guys year six now?
I think so. I mean, Donovan's already... Yeah, I don't even know.
That's half my career ago as far as NBA coverage. Wow.
Do you have anything else you want to say about Utah or even the Pelicans, who also saw their season end real quick? We should probably just say
just how excited I was to watch them play. Like, it's a weird thing to say, but I'm really happy for Willie Green. I'm really happy for the Pelicans and their fan base in a year where I'm starting to get really tired and really fed up with the one of the only narratives that comes up with these teams, certainly on a national scale, is that people start like the countdown clock for Donovan Mitchell and I mean, that's with him having been with the winning team, you know, one of the three or four most winningest teams over the last 5 years in Utah. But, you know, God forbid Zion or, you know, if Ja had been with Memphis and they had been terrible this year or next year and the year to come, people just start the countdown clock for guys in small markets that are fun to watch. And so that was happening with Zion. Granted, some of the stuff behind the scenes in New Orleans was not helping, which maybe Zion and his team were not cognizant of, or maybe they were very cognizant of. But I hated that that was really the only conversation happening with them, even as they started to turn it around. So I'm really happy that they made it into the playoffs. I'm really happy that they pushed Phoenix the way they did. I'm sure they're not, but there's nothing to be ashamed of when Chris Paul goes 14 for 14 against
perfect.
You.
Perfect. Needs to be perfect to beat you.
Well, insane. I mean, so I love that. I frankly, for the sport, I love that it pushed the best team in the league to have to play that well and to play that hard. I don't think they were coasting. They were just getting Devin Booker back. So, I mean, I think that's relevant, but it will make Phoenix better, you would think, for this round, for the next round, whenever, you know, however far they go. That is a difficult series, and a really good team in New Orleans that has a ton to build around. And it sounds like Zion, at least in this Baggy Day press conference that he gave, essentially said that, and I mean, in some ways it shouldn't be that surprising, but basically said that he wants to, you know, if they put an extension from him, he's going to sign it. Again, maybe that shouldn't be that surprising, just given that he's been out for a year. Maybe anybody in that position should want to sign, but you know, that team, whether he's there or not, or whatever his situation is going to be, New Orleans is so much fun. And you had written about them before. I think you already knew that. A lot of folks there already knew that. I think some folks around the league knew that, but for them to show it on that stage, just pests defensively, a lot of offense and a lot of talent offensively. Super fun team, super excited for their future.
Yeah, we had the Pelicans conversation a couple months ago on the podcast. We had it in the context of, could they push the Phoenix Suns in a playoff series?
I remember that.
And obviously we didn't know that Devin Booker would get hurt, which changed everything.
Right.
But they still were, they were like a feisty, competitive team. Brandon Ingram really showed up in basically every game. Herb Jones is just like, I mean, he's going to go down as like one of the all-time great perimeter wing defenders, just an absolute monster of a basketball player.
Can I say one thing? CJ having five fouls so early, and that the way the game was called in some ways, that was the only thing that was that was frustrating to me about the game last night, is that it was a great game even with that, but when you think about some of the things that, you know, the idea that Phoenix was able to do just enough to beat them, some of the calls were, and I think that that's been the case with a lot of these series, really. Some of the calls were like, really, you know, like with a game that's that great with CJ, it's so rare to see someone, a guard with five fouls, like early in the third quarter. And so then you obviously didn't see him until later in the fourth, but that, you know, it was such a hard fought series. That really pushed Phoenix, that if you're New Orleans, you've got to be extremely, extremely proud and feel really good about next season.
Yeah, just looking ahead at a potential starting five for next year, Brandon Ingram, Herb Jones, CJ McCollum, Zion, and I'm going to say Larry Nance Jr., just because, like, I know it's just one game, but like him being, he was really good. I feel like, honestly, he's more of a postseason player than a regular season player. And like, shout out to Jonas Valanciunas, who's, I feel like
he grabbed every offensive rebound there was to be had.
Exactly. But I feel like their roles are reversed in that sense, but that would be just an unbelievable starting five. And, you know, Trey Murphy hitting playoff threes, just a wonderful experience for them and their development and their growth. Okay, let's talk about the teams that actually won. The Suns, the Mavericks. I was saying a few minutes ago, or maybe 20 minutes ago now, that this is my favorite second round series. I know that you're a huge Suns person. Are you still feeling pretty confident in Phoenix, even with Devin Booker's hamstring and Devin Booker maybe not being 100% from the jump, in Phoenix prevailing in this series? Or just what are your general thoughts? What matchups are intriguing to you? And do you give, I'll just say off the top, I pick Mavs in seven because I'm are you still like, okay, Suns are gonna roll, or just what are your thoughts here?
No. I mean, I picked the Suns here, but I did so in seven. I don't think this is, I mean, there's no reason to think that the Mavs would be an easy matchup for anyone. I am a little bit worried about what I just told you about before with, for the Bucks and to some extent for Philly, the idea of going from one opponent that defends one way or has limitations one way, and then going against an opponent that really does not have those limitations. So we talked about basically Utah and how much they struggled defensively. and the idea of the Mavs just being able to play tic-tac-toe even before Luka was back to just basically hit Kleber in the corner. That's not going to be the case against the Suns. I mean, the Suns are going to have guys that can really defend Luka, that can defend Brunson, that are not just going to leave an open pass to the corner because of their limitations or because of how bad their perimeter defense is. The Suns have a very good perimeter defense. So, I think that still, obviously, guys in Dallas's rotation will present a challenge. Luka does that with everybody. One of the matchups I'm most curious about in this series, and a name that I feel like doesn't get mentioned enough considering how good Dallas was defensively this year. And I think because they don't really have like stud defenders, or at least that many of them with that team, this is probably the guy most deserving of kind of the credit is Dorian Finney-Smith in this series. Him and really, I would imagine at times he's going to be taking Chris Paul in this series. So looking at the matchup numbers from the regular season, the Suns scored 65 points as a team in 67 possessions when Dorian Finney-Smith guarded Chris Paul during the regular season, which is a really, 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 really low number. So Finney-Smith is someone I was going to be curious about in this series anyway. One, because he did such a good job on Mitchell in the last series. But I am really, really curious to see what that looks like in this series. And to some extent, we just watched Chris Paul do what he did in this last game where he literally didn't miss a shot. The clutch games were a big, big storyline between these two teams in terms of how well they performed in the clutch at certain moments. Mm-hmm. Obviously the Suns, we've seen the numbers on them when they lead after three quarters. We just saw what Chris Paul did to end the game. The Mavs play incredibly slow, because of the way Luka is pretty deliberate with his offense. So all that stuff is going to matter. Chris Paul, how he's defended, whether they can get in him a little bit more, even though the Pelicans have guards that defend very well. So Dorian Finney-Smith and Chris Paul, Dorian Finney-Smith and just how he defends in this series to me is a huge, huge, huge question about who wins the series and how.
So I like all respect to Phoenix. One of the reasons why I'm going Mavs in seven and thinking that they can win a game seven on the road is just Devin Booker's health is a small but not insignificant variable here.
Not insignificant at all.
And also, honestly, Chris Paul is going to be turning 37, I think, during this series. And I know he just had like a historically perfect, flawless basketball game, but like, at some point, he's going to wear down just a bit, I would imagine.
And damn, did you say so the fact that he's turning 37 factors into that, huh? He's 36 and 358 days old now. But when he hits 37, bruh, watch out. The wheels are going to come all the way off.
No, but what I will say in all seriousness, like, what I love about Dallas, I wrote about this earlier this season, back when they had Kristaps actually, and I know that they didn't defend necessarily at the same high level after that trade. But when you defend, and they defended in this playoff series, when you defend and you have Luka, playoff Luka, like, you are ridiculous. And they have Dorian Finney-Smith, as you said, and Reggie Bullock. And those two led Dallas in minutes in this series. Those are two like critical cogs. They will be asked to do so much defensively. Both of them shot 40% behind the three-point line in the series. When they shoot threes like that, when they defend, when they play big minutes without fouling, like, Dallas is, I don't want to say unbeatable, of course not, but that is just like, that's exactly what you want next to Luka. And when you can go small, like, I would be fast. Like, one of the things about Phoenix that's really interesting to me is their inability or kind of like, they don't really want to go small ever. And Ayton kind of, you know, causes some hesitancy in opposing coaches too. Like, we don't want to go small against DeAndre Ayton. Like, credit to him. He's incredible.
Man, That dude, sorry.
He's great. He's great. No, DeAndre Ayton's great, deserves everything. Obvious yeah. max player, like just close the book on that conversation forever.
Thank you.
But like Finney Smith, Bullock, Jalen Brunson, Spencer Dinwiddie, Luka Doncic. I want to see that lineup against the Suns with Ayton on the court and just see what happens. Obviously defensively that could be a little bit of an issue. I think Brunson is a solid defender. Dinwiddie's long and Luka is like playing hard, honestly, on the defense. Besides the first game back, he's had moments where he's actually defending. He can rebound. That's just like a really intriguing small group that I want to see. I also want to see Luka in the post on Mikal Bridges, on whoever they put him on. And also, I do think that they will do a lot of targeting with Luka on CP, on Devin Booker, force those guys to guard Luka down low, force those guys to guard him in isolation. Luka just creates issues that are outside of a game plan. And he's a truly great player. His level of expertise goes up a notch in the playoffs. One of the greatest starts to a postseason career ever that we've ever seen.
Yeah.
And
finally has like, a playoff series win now, which feels crazy to have had that much success individually. And obviously right. they got close to winning series before, but to
he finally makes a few have free throws last year and doesn't go up right. against like the greatest, one of the greatest players in NBA history, then
right.
you know, he has one, but
exactly.
Luka's phenomenal. So that's why I'm going Mavs in seven by
a great
hair.
Series.
I think it's going to be super competitive, super fun. Really looking forward to it.
Fingers crossed for good health, just like yes. as we talk about Booker and obviously Luka just coming off his injury too. So it would be great to see that those two teams play and not have any injury concerns come up.
100%.
Especially okay. when we're looking at that with the East too.
Okay, Chris, I want to close with I want to get to an email real quick. We'll close on the email. Before we get to the email though, quick predictions about, I just want real quick, Celtics, Bucks, give me your prediction. We're not going to have a big conversation.
Sure.
Just tell me what you're thinking.
Celtics in seven.
Seven. Okay. I have Celtics in five.
Well, there's no Middleton. So, I mean, I get it. I was tempted to go six. Five briefly floated through my mind, but I'm like, man, I don't think they're going to bottle up Giannis like that. Like, I don't think Giannis is going to get bottled up like KD did for the first couple games. And if you take that away and you take those games away, Brooklyn probably does get one of those games. So I don't know. But then again, for me to say, how could you pick them in five? That means that Giannis has to get multiple games for it to not go five. So I don't know. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. It could play either way. There's no Middleton, so it's not crazy. And I do think Boston's the better team now, so that's not crazy.
Boston is great. And I feel like they are – I mean, I know they were built to stop Giannis. That's how they were built. The Horford trade, drafting Rob Williams. It's like Giannis and Embiid are like the two guys who they have on their mind as an organization that we have to get past. And I feel like they have all the pieces – multiple pieces, bodies to throw at Giannis, and it'll take some lights out 3-point shooting, I think, to beat them.
It'll be interesting. Now they had it against the Bulls, but again the Bulls, man,
it was the Bulls.
They had to sell all the way out and leave guys all the way open to where Grayson Allen was hitting 70% from the 3-point line, but all of his looks were wide open. So
yes,
Boston's
yes.
ability to recover when they're walling off somebody like Giannis will be important, but obviously they can do that better than the Bulls can. So it would take really, really hot 3-point shooting, but I wouldn't take that off the table for at least a game or two with Milwaukee. They're capable of doing that, certainly.
Okay. And real quick prediction for game six. This is going to be like completely useless by the time most people listen to this, but I just want to get you on the record. Game six, who you got tonight? Grizzlies, Timberwolves.
I'll take Minnesota for this. I think it'll go seven. I feel bad in advance because I know a certain somebody is out covering that series, tired and under the weather. So I'm hoping that you don't have to cover it much longer. But I really do feel like, you know, as the conversations hovered around for a while about Minnesota and just these blown leads, you're doing something right in the first place to get the leads. And, you know, so they, I think they've held their own from that standpoint. They just haven't been able to hold on to them. So I think that they'll come out. I think that they'll win tonight and force the issue back to Memphis for game seven.
Memphis in a blowout, please. Jesus. That's all I want. That would be really great. Even though I love the Timberwolves, love their fans, love people in Minneapolis. Everyone is so nice in both of these cities, but please,
Memphis, now you're just trying not to get beat up because you're saying exactly. You don't want them to win.
Exactly. Okay, I want to close with this email from Zach real quick. Zach writes, how much should we take into account how NBA players evaluate other NBA players? The Nets debacle is a good framing for this issue. We have heard current and former players say over and over how Kyrie is the most talented guard or offensive player in the NBA and maybe ever, how he is undoubtedly one of the greatest 75 players of all time and maybe in the top 20. Giannis called KD the best player in the NBA in a league where Jokic, Embiid, and Giannis himself are putting up literally unprecedented numbers. Do players value different things than fans? Is there an appreciation for certain skill sets amongst players that overrides the analytics and maybe even contributes to basketball success? Should we care whether Giannis thinks KD is the best player in the NBA and Iguodala thinks Kyrie is a top 20 guy of all time? Thank you, Zach. I wanted to hit this email. I just think it's a really fascinating question. We could have held it into the offseason, but really interesting thought exercise that could drive conversation for like an hour. Just what are your synthesized thoughts in answering this, Chris?
I absolutely think there's a difference in the way that they view players versus the way fans do. I think even reporters do. But I will say this. I mean, we've had this question about Jokic for a while as far as why does it seem like so many people in the league are kind of, I won't say anti-Jokic, but they don't talk up his game that much. They kind of, you know, when people are asked their opinion about who should win MVP, LeBron and everybody else, they always kind of say, give it to Embiid, give it to such and such. Actually, I don't know if LeBron has said that about Embiid, but, you know, plenty of people have done that over the last year or two, or they feel like other people should, you know, be in the conversation. And it's kind of like, it feels like it's a slight on Jokic because he, you know, is going to win the award, but none of the biggest names are saying he's the most deserving guy. And then you have the situation with Kyrie, where I think there's something to be said about the unstoppability of him. When these guys play against him, I think that the highlights stand out, the skill set stands out. But I will also say that Kyrie is interesting because we saw him in an example very early in his career where he was not lifting a really poor team on his own by himself, wasn't able to do that at that point in his career. Then LeBron kind of swooped in. And so Kyrie was kind of put in a different stratosphere at that point as far as winning. And all of a sudden, so now I don't know if he really became a winning player because of that or if there's a such thing as a winning player. We've seen that conversation shift now on Devin Booker to some extent with Trae Young, certainly up until this year with Trae Young. I think the Bulls for a while were allowing Zach LaVine to kind of shift in terms of the perception of some of that. And I don't know if maybe there's too much emphasis on that. Someone has skills or they don't. Kyrie's always had the skills, but I don't know that all of it translates to winning by himself as like the key guy on his team by himself. So that's going to color the way we think. I don't know that that colors the way NBA players think. Like, I think NBA players probably felt like Trae Young was a badass before they went to the Eastern Conference Finals last year. I think a lot of NBA players probably felt Devin Booker was a badass before last year. So I don't know. I do think that there's a difference, but I do think also you can look at Kyrie and tell he plays a lot differently than a lot of people, and most people can't do what he does. And in a lot of people's minds, that is going to kind of determine whether they're one of the best players or not. We think that way too, but we also have a lot of stuff that we're bringing to the table from a statistical standpoint that a lot of the players are not paying attention to. In the same way that when we talk about clutch shooting numbers and everything else and about the idea that, yes, Kobe's made more game winners than anybody, but he's also taken so many more than anybody else. And his percentage of made shots in those situations is lower than most guys. So it's a framing thing. And I don't think that NBA players frame that the same way that people that are paid to talk about it for a living do, or people in front offices do. And that's okay that they don't. They've got a different level of experience with it. And I can respect that level of experience.
Yeah. I mean, they're just two separate points of view. Both have value. You talk to veterans around the NBA about, or ask them questions like this, which I have, and they'll say that, you know, front offices and writers who really value analytics are just looking at spreadsheets and really not calculating competitive fire, night to night spirit, like a care factor, just someone's mental makeup in a high leverage situation versus a meaningless January regular season game. I think players can contribute in knowing stuff like that absolutely better than anyone. And it's fascinating to hear what they think. One of the most interesting examples is just like anytime Draymond Green has something to say about players around the league, my ears perk up because I'm going to learn something.
Which he just did that about Jokic, which is interesting because it makes me wonder whether the tide. And again, like I think all respect to Rohan. He's our buddy. I love him. He wrote the piece earlier this year on whether there was a perception that Jokic wasn't getting enough respect. He's going to win MVP for a second time in a row. So even if there's a perceived, I think we can say two things at the same time, that he might not be fully appreciated by NBA players as much as we would think, given that he's going to win a second straight MVP, but he's also not getting less respect, certainly from the voters. And even just generally, like, he's getting enough respect. It's just a question of whether NBA players see him as like the unquestioned superstar as he is. And maybe in some ways you could say that is less respect than he deserves. Okay, whatever. But it was really interesting to see Draymond, after matching up with him and having his hands full with that matchup, say this dude can play, and going out of his way to say that. It was also very cool to see Jokic kind of respond in kind by saying the same thing basically about Draymond and all the stuff he does. But it makes me wonder, when Draymond says something like that out loud, and watching him play against Draymond and do as well as he did against Draymond in that series, whether that's enough to shift the tide that, of the perception that we have of the way NBA players think about him or talk about him or don't talk about him. But yeah, like you said, Draymond, no one's going to question his basketball knowledge. Super intelligent just from as a player, very easily could be an analyst. And obviously it's kind of doing that in that role now.
He is an analyst. I mean, the other side of the coin is just like, sometimes you hear players bring, I don't even know how you would describe it, as you were saying earlier, Chris, kind of like a personal baggage into the conversation where, like, sure, for example, Rudy Gobert is disrespected. He's a punching bag. I think it was Anthony Edwards who said, like, Kristaps was a better rim protector or something. I'm going off the top of my head, but like stuff like that. It's just like, are you serious when you said that? Like, what are you? Is there like something you're trying to get across that has nothing to do with answering the question?
You know what? So speaking of Draymond and how good he is at this, and this is not completely analogous, but I thought it was really interesting that I think today, literally, he was talking about trash talk and guys that, you know, you'd kind of have to just shut up and play. He brought up Karl-Anthony Towns. And he didn't come all the way out and say it, but he said, I've noticed that Cat's been talking a whole lot this year, and just a lot of gestures and a lot of, you know, like the air ball thing where he acted like there was a breeze coming. Uh-huh. And, you know, he's been talking a lot in this series and saying a lot in this series. And he was like, you know, I just don't think that's like, we've never seen that from him before. I just kind of feel like we know that's not who Cat is, or like, we're not convinced that's who Cat is. Basically, like, you're not that guy. And I just kind of feel like NBA players see you as being that guy and having that tenacity, or they don't. And that's what I'm saying about Draymond as it relates to Jokic, is I think a lot of people see or saw Jokic that way in the NBA. And Draymond was coming out of his shell to say, or not his shell, Draymond certainly does not have a shell, but Draymond went out of his way to say, Jokic is not soft. And it was almost like, I don't know that this opened his eyes to that. I'm sure he knew that on some level, how great he was, but playing against him game after game after game, and Draymond knowing how great a defender he is, it was almost like he was saying, like, we can eliminate that thought that Jokic was ever softer than he is now, because he's not. So I do kind of feel like there's like a label on guys, of guys that might be a little soft around the edges or in the middle a little bit. And I think when there's that perception that exists, you have to do something to take it away in the eyes of NBA players that may not exist as much, certainly for people that are paying much closer attention to the numbers and to the tendencies and other things. And that does not exist the same way for players, for sure.
Some guys are just, yeah, punching bags. And it's really hard to shake a reputation like that. And perceptions don't, they're not altered overnight in the NBA. So Gobert, Cat, trying to think of who else, just really talented players, but don't seem to have the proper respect level that from their peers that maybe you or I do in watching them and studying them and looking at their contributions on the court numerically. Which is,
and
just,
does it feel like to you that it's, that it, that it's tied to a perception of softness? I mean, like, I think that might be the best way to put it, that guys that, I don't know why, like with Jokic, I'm not sure why. He's not a guy that just, I mean, he bangs guys in the post. But I guess there was the knock for a few years that, like, body wise, the composition of his body was not great. You know, at least the way it was perceived, the conditioning was not great as of a few years ago. That knock's not there anymore. So I mean, that's, but I don't know. I maybe there's still something to be said about Europeans and the way people think about Europeans. Carl Anthony Towns is not European, but I think that it is rooted somewhat in the toughness factor that people, no one's ever said that about Ja. Like, and we, like, the way he talks and the confidence that he plays with and speaks with, I feel like would set him apart. So no one would say anything about Ja. So I think that's, a lot of times, I think that's what it is. Like, I, you know, when we talk about the respect factor, I've never been able to pin down what it was with Giannis. You know, and maybe it's a foreign thing, but people have been big on Luka since the minute he came in the league. So I don't know what it is.
There's, again, I knew this question was going to open up just a million different avenues that we could go down. Like, just a fascinating topic of conversation that maybe we'll revisit in the off season. But I think that's going to do it for today's show. Chris, thank you so much for your insight, your expertise. Thank you so much to our listeners for sending in all of your wonderful emails. Please keep them coming to openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. Everybody, please stay safe. Everybody, please continue to enjoy the NBA playoffs.
Medical Mutual wants to remind you it's almost time for Medicare's annual enrollment period. As a trusted health insurer for more than 90 years, Medical Mutual is here to help you find better Medicare benefits. Be confident you're getting the most from your Medicare Advantage plan. Schedule your free Medicare plan review today at medmutual.com/review. Medical Mutual, Ohio's hometown Medicare insurer.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.